After I picked up my ticket, I announced rather casually that I would be leaving the following day. My revelation was accepted with at least the equal amount of detachment, only it was not a pose, and everyone wished me well. I didn't want to say goodbye to the junkyard or to my car, so I spent my last night at an all-night movie. One girl whose name and face have melted into the years gave me an all-enduring friendship ring, and Juan gave me a black lace handkerchief, just in case I wanted to go to church sometime. I arrived in San Francisco, leaner than usual, fairly unkempt, and with no luggage. Mother took one look and said, "Is the rationing that bad at your father's? You'd better have some food to stick to all those bones." She, as she called it, turned to, and soon I was at a clothed table with bowls of food expressly cooked for me. I was at a home again. And my mother was a fine lady. Dolores was a fool, and more important, a liar. 33. The house seemed smaller and quieter after the trip south, and the first bloom of San Francisco's glamour had dulled around the edges. Adults had lost the wisdom from the surface of their faces. I reasoned that I had given up some youth for knowledge, but my gain was more valuable than the loss. Bailey was much older, too, even years older than I had become. He had made friends during that youth-shattering summer with a group of slick street boys. His language had changed. He was forever dropping slangy terms into his sentences like dumplings in a pot. He may have been glad to see me, but he didn't act much like it. When I tried to tell him of my adventures and misadventures, he responded with a casual indifference which stilled the tale on my lips. His new companions cluttered the living room and halls, wearing zoot suits and wide-brimmed hats and dangling long snaky chains hooked at their belts. They drank slow gin secretly and told dirty jokes. Although I had no regrets, I told myself sadly that growing up was not the painless process one would have thought it to be. In one area, my brother and I found ourselves closer. I had gotten the knack of public dancing. All the lessons with Mother, who danced so effortlessly, had not borne immediate fruit. But with my newly and dearly bought assurance, I could give myself up to the rhythms and let them propel me where they willed. Mother allowed us to go to the big band dances in the crowded city auditorium. We danced the Jitterbug to Count Basie, the Lindy and the Big Apple to Cab Calloway, and the halftime Texas Hop to Duke Ellington. In a matter of months, Cute Bailey and his tall sister were famous as those dancing fools, which was an apt description. Although I had risked my life, not intentionally, in her defense, Mother's reputation, good name, and community image ceased, or nearly ceased, being of interest to me. It was not that I cared for her less, but that I concerned myself less with everything and everyone. I often thought of the tedium of life once one has seen all its surprises. In 2 months, I had become blasé. Mother and Bailey were entangled in an Oedipal skein. Neither could do without or with the other. Yet the constrictions of conscience and society, morality and ethos, dictated a separation. On some flimsy excuse, Mother ordered Bailey out of the house. On an equally flimsy excuse, he complied. Bailey was 16, small for his age, bright for any age, and hopelessly in love with Mother dear. Her heroes were her friends, and her friends were big men in the rackets. They wore $200 Chesterfield coats, Bush shoes at $50 a pair, and Knox hats. Their shirts were monogrammed, and their fingernails manicured. How could a 16-year-old boy hope to compete with such overshadowing rivals? He did what he had to do. He acquired a withered white prostitute, a diamond ring on his little finger, and a Harris tweed coat with raglan sleeves. He didn't consciously consider the new possessions, the open sesame, to Mother Dear's vault of acceptance, and she had no idea that her preferences prodded him to such excesses. From the wings, I heard and watched the pavane of tragedy move steadily toward its climax. Interception and even the thought of it was impossible. Easier to plan an obstruction to a sunrise or a hurricane. If Mother was a beautiful woman who exacted the tribute of obeisance from all men, she was also a mother and a damned good one. No son of hers was going to be exploited by a used-up white whore who wanted to milk him of his youth and spoil him for adulthood. Hell no. Bailey, for his part, was her son, and she was his mother. He had no intention of taking low, even from the most beautiful woman in the world. The fact that she happened to be his mother did nothing to weaken his resolve. Get out? Oh, hell yes. Tomorrow? What's wrong with today? Today? What about right now? But neither could move until all the measured steps had been negotiated. During the weeks of bitter wrangling, I sat in hopeless wonder. We were not allowed profanity or even obvious sarcasm, but Bailey looped his language around his tongue and issued it out to Mother in alum drops. She threw her ing-bings, passionate explosions, guaranteed to depilate the chest of the strongest man, and was sweetly sorry, only to me, after. I had been left out of their power-love struggles. It would be more correct to say that since neither needed a clack, I was forgotten on the sidelines. It was a little like Switzerland in World War II. Shells were bursting all around me. Souls were tortured, and I was powerless in the confines of imposed neutrality. Hopes were dying. The confrontation which brought relief had come on an ordinary, unheralded evening. It was after 11 o'clock, so I left my door ajar, hoping to hear Mother go out, or the creak of Bailey easing up the stairs. The record player on the first floor volumed up Lonnie Johnson, singing, "Tomorrow night, will you remember what you said tonight?" Glasses clinked and voices rubbed each other. A party was shimmering below, and Bailey had defied Mother's 11 o'clock curfew. If he made it in before midnight, she might be satisfied with slapping him across the face a few times with her lashing words. 12 o'clock came and went at once, and I sat up in bed and laid my cards out for the first of many games of solitaire. Bailey? My watch hands made the uneven V of 1 o'clock. Yes, Mother Dear? On guard. His voice thrust sweet and sour, and he accented the dear. I guess you're a man. Turn down that record player, she shouted the last to the revelers. I'm your son, Mother Dear, a swift parry. Is it 11 o'clock, Bailey? That was a feint designed to catch the opponent off guard. It's after 1 o'clock, Mother Dear. He had opened up the game, and the strokes from then on would have to be direct. Clydell is the only man in this house, and if you think you're so much of a man, her voice popped like a razor on a strap. I'm leaving now, Mother Dear. The deferential tone heightened the content of his announcement. In a bloodless coup, he had thrust beneath her visor. Now laid open, she had no recourse but to hurry along the tunnel of her anger, headlong. Then, goddammit, get your heels to clicking. And her heels were clicking down the linoleum hall as Bailey tap-danced up the stairs to his room. When rain comes finally, washing away a low sky of muddy ochre, we who could not control the phenomenon are pressed into relief. The near occult feeling, the fact of being witness to the end of the world, gives way to tangible things. Even if the succeeding sensations are not common, they are at least not mysterious. Bailey was leaving home. At 1 o'clock in the morning, my little brother, who in my lonely days of inferno dwelling had protected me from goblins, gnomes, gremlins, and the devils, was leaving home. I had known all along the inevitable outcome, and that I dared not poke into his knapsack of misery, even with the offer to help him carry it. I went to his room, against my judgment, and found him throwing his carefully tended clothes into a pillowcase. His maturity embarrassed me. In his little face, balled up like a fist, I found no vestige of my brother. And when, not knowing what to say, I asked if I could help, he answered, "Leave me the shit alone." I leaned on the door jamb, lending him my physical presence, but said no more. "She wants me out, does she? Well, I'll get out of here so fast I leave the air on fire. She calls herself a mother? Huh, I'll be damned. She's seen the last of me. I can make it. I'll always make it." At some point, he noticed me, still in the doorway, and his consciousness stretched to remember our relationship. "Mai, if you want to leave now, come on. I'll take care of you." He didn't wait for an answer, but as quickly went back to speaking to his soul. "She won't miss me, and I sure as hell won't miss her. To hell with her and everybody else." He had finished jamming his shoes on top of his shirts and ties, and socks were wadded into the pillowcase. He remembered me again. "Mai, you can have my books." My tears were not for Bailey, our mother, or even myself, but for the helplessness of mortals who live on the sufferance of life. In order to avoid this bitter end, we would all have to be born again, and born with the knowledge of alternatives, even then. Bailey grabbed up the lumpy pillowcase and pushed by me for the stairs. As the front door slammed, the record player downstairs mastered the house. And Nat King Cole warned the world to straighten up and fly right. As if they could, as if human beings could make a choice. Mother's eyes were red and her face puffy the next morning, but she smiled her "everything is everything" smile and turned in tight little moons, making breakfast, talking business, and brightening the corner where she was. No one mentioned Bailey's absence, as if things were as they should be, and always were. The house was smudged with unspoken thoughts, and it was necessary to go to my room to breathe. I believed I knew where he headed the night before, and made up my mind to find him and offer him my support. In the afternoon, I went to a bay-windowed house, which boasted "rooms" in green and orange letters through the glass. A woman of any age past 30 answered my ring and said Bailey Johnson was at the top of the stairs. His eyes were as red as Mother's had been, but his face had loosened a little from the tightness of the night before. In an almost formal manner, I was invited into a room with a clean, chenille-covered bed, an easy chair, a gas fireplace, and a table. He began to talk, covering up the unusual situation that we found ourselves in. "Nice room, isn't it? You know, it's very hard to find rooms now, the war and all. Betty lives here. She was the white prostitute. And she got this place for me. My, you know it's better this way. I mean, I'm a man, and I have to be on my own. I was furious that he didn't curse and abuse the fates, or mother, or at least act put upon. Well, I thought to start it, if mother was really a mother, she wouldn't have. He stopped me with his little black hand held up as if I were to read his palm. Wait, my, she was right. There is a tide and time in every man's life. Bailey, you're 16. Chronologically, yes, but I haven't been 16 for years. Anyway, there comes a time when a man must cut the apron strings and face life on his own. As I was saying to Mother, dear, I've come to... When you were talking to Mother this morning, I said to Mother, dear, did you phone her? Yes, and she came by here. We had a very fruitful discussion. He chose his words with the precision of a Sunday school teacher. She understands completely. There is a time in every man's life when he must push off from the wharf of safety into the sea of chance. Anyway, she is arranging with a friend of hers in Oakland to get me on the Southern Pacific. My, it's just a start. I'll begin as a dining car waiter, and then a steward, and when I know all there is to know about that, I'll branch out. The future looks good. The black man hasn't even begun to storm the battlefronts. I'm going for broke myself. His room smelled of cooked grease, Lysol, and age, but his face believed the freshness of his words, and I had no heart nor art to drag him back to the reeking reality of our life and times. Whores were lying down first and getting up last in the room next door. Chicken suppers and gambling games were rioting on a 24-hour basis downstairs. Sailors and soldiers on their doom-lined road to war cracked windows and broke locks for blocks around, hoping to leave their imprint on a building or in the memory of a victim. A chance to be perpetrated. Bailey sat wrapped in his decision and anesthetized by youth. If I had had any suggestion to make, I couldn't have penetrated his unlucky armor. And most regrettable, I had no suggestion to make. I'm your sister, and whatever I can do, I'll do it. My, don't worry about me. That's all I want you to do. Don't worry. I'll be okie dokie. I left his room because and only because we had said all we could say. The unsaid words pushed roughly against the thoughts that we had no craft to verbalize and crowded the room to uneasiness. 34. Later, my room had all the cheeriness of a dungeon and the appeal of a tomb. It was going to be impossible to stay there, but leaving held no attraction for me either. Running away from home would be anticlimactic after Mexico and a dull story after my month in the car lot. But the need for change bulldozed a road down the center of my mind. I had it. The answer came to me with the suddenness of a collision. I would go to work. Mother wouldn't be difficult to convince. After all, in school, I was a year ahead of my grade, and Mother was a firm believer in self-sufficiency. In fact, she'd be pleased to think that I had that much gumption, that much of her in my character. She liked to speak of herself as the original do-it-yourself girl. Once I had settled on getting a job, all that remained was to decide which kind of job I was most fitted for. My intellectual pride had kept me from selecting typing, shorthand, or filing as subjects in school. So, office work was ruled out. War plants and shipyards demanded birth certificates, and mine would reveal me to be 15 and ineligible for work. So the well-paying defense jobs were also out. Women had replaced men on the streetcars as conductors and motormen, and the thought of sailing up and down the hills of San Francisco in a dark blue uniform with a money changer at my belt caught my fancy. Mother was as easy as I had anticipated. The world was moving so fast. So much money was being made. So many people were dying in Guam and Germany that hordes of strangers became good friends overnight. Life was cheap and death entirely free. How could she have the time to think about my academic career? To her question of what I planned to do, I replied that I would get a job on the streetcars. She rejected the proposal with, "They don't accept colored people on the streetcars." I would like to claim an immediate fury, which was followed by the noble determination to break the restricting tradition. But the truth is, my first reaction was one of disappointment. I had pictured myself dressed in a neat blue serge suit, my money changer swinging jauntily at my waist, a cheery smile for the passengers which would make their own workday brighter. From disappointment, I gradually ascended the emotional ladder to haughty indignation, and finally to that state of stubbornness where the mind is locked like the jaws of an enraged bulldog. I would go to work on the streetcars and wear a blue serge suit. Mother gave me her support with one of her usual terse asides. "That's what you want to do? Then nothing beats a trial but a failure. Give it everything you've got. I've told you many times, can't do is like don't care. Neither of them has a home." Translated, that meant there was nothing a person can't do, and there should be nothing a human being didn't care about. It was the most positive encouragement I could have hoped for. In the offices of the Market Street Railway Company, the receptionist seemed as surprised to see me there as I was to find the interior dingy and the decor drab. Somehow I had expected waxed surfaces and carpeted floors. If I had met no resistance, I might have decided against working for such a poor-mouth-looking concern. As it was, I explained that I had come to see about a job. She asked, was I sent by an agency? And when I replied that I was not, she told me they were only accepting applicants from agencies. The classified pages of the morning papers had listed advertisements for motorettes and conductorettes, and I reminded her of that. She gave me a face full of astonishment that my suspicious nature would not accept. "I am applying for the job listed in this morning's Chronicle, and I'd like to be presented to your personnel manager." When I spoke in supercilious accents and looked at the room as if I had an oil well in my own backyard, my armpits were being pricked by millions of hot pointed needles. She saw her escape and dived into it. "He's out. He's out for the day. You might call tomorrow, and if he's in, I'm sure you can see him." Then she swiveled her chair around on its rusty screws, and with that, I was supposed to be dismissed. "May I ask his name?" She half turned, acting surprised to find me still there. "His name? Whose name?" "Your personnel manager." We were firmly joined in the hypocrisy to play out the scene. "The personnel manager? Oh, he's Mr. Cooper, but I'm not sure you'll find him here tomorrow. He's... Oh, but you can try." "Thank you." "You're welcome." And I was out of the musty room and into the even mustier lobby. In the street, I saw the receptionist and myself going faithfully through paces that were stale with familiarity. Although I had never encountered that kind of situation before, and probably neither had she. We were like actors who, knowing the play by heart, were still able to cry afresh over the old tragedies and laugh spontaneously at the comic situations. The miserable little encounter had nothing to do with me, the me of me, any more than it had to do with that silly clerk. The incident was a recurring dream concocted years before by stupid whites, and it eternally came back to haunt us all. The secretary and I were like Hamlet and Laertes in the final scene, where because of harm done by one ancestor to another, we were bound to duel to the death, also because the play must end somewhere. I went further than forgiving the clerk. I accepted her as a fellow victim of the same puppeteer. On the streetcar, I put my fare into the box, and the conductorette looked at me with the usual hard eyes of white contempt. "Move into the car. Please move on in the car." She patted her money changer. Her southern nasal accent sliced my meditation, and I looked deep into my thoughts. All lies. All comfortable lies. The receptionist was not innocent, and neither was I. The whole charade we had played out in that crummy waiting room had directly to do with me, black, and her, white. I wouldn't move into the streetcar, but stood on the ledge over the conductor, glaring. My mind shouted so energetically that the announcement made my veins stand out and my mouth tighten into a prune. I would have the job. I would be a conductorette and sling a full money changer from my belt. I would. The next 3 weeks were a honeycomb of determination, with apertures for the days to go in and out. The Negro organizations to whom I appealed for support bounced me back and forth like a shuttlecock on a badminton court. Why did I insist on that particular job? Openings were going begging that paid nearly twice the money. The minor officials with whom I was able to win an audience thought me mad. Possibly I was. Downtown San Francisco became alien and cold, and the streets I had loved in a personal familiarity were unknown lanes that twisted with malicious intent. Old buildings whose gray rococo facades housed my memories of the 49ers and Diamond Lil, Robert Service, Sutter, and Jack London were then imposing structures viciously joined to keep me out. My trips to the streetcar office were on the frequency of a person on salary. The struggle expanded. I was no longer in conflict only with the Market Street Railway, but with the marble lobby of the building, which housed its offices and elevators and their operators. During this period of strain, Mother and I began our first steps on a long path toward mutual adult admiration. She never asked for reports, and I didn't offer any details. But every morning she made breakfast, gave me car fare and lunch money, as if I were going to work. She comprehended the perversity of life, that in the struggle lies the joy. That I was no glory seeker was obvious to her, and that I had to exhaust every possibility before giving in was also clear. On my way out of the house one morning, she said, "Life is going to give you just what you put in it. Put your whole heart in everything you do and pray. Then you can wait." Another time she reminded me that God helps those who help themselves. She had a store of aphorisms which she dished out as the occasion demanded. Strangely, as bored as I was with cliches, her inflection gave them something new and set me thinking, for a while at least. Later, when asked how I got my job, I was never able to say exactly. I only knew that one day, which was tiresomely like all the others before it, I sat in the railway office, ostensibly waiting to be interviewed. The receptionist called me to her desk and shuffled a bundle of papers to me. They were job application forms. She said they had to be filled in triplicate. I had little time to wonder if I had won or not. for the standard questions reminded me of the necessity for dexterous lying. How old was I? List my previous jobs, starting with the last hill and go backwards to the first. How much money did I earn, and why did I leave the position? Give two references, not relatives. Sitting at a side table, my mind and I wove a cat's ladder of near truths and total lies. I kept my face blank and old art, and wrote quickly the fable of Marguerite Johnson, age 19, former companion and driver for Miss Annie Henderson, a white lady, in Stamps, Arkansas. I was given blood tests, aptitude tests, physical coordination tests, and Rorschachs. Then, on a blissful day, I was hired as the first Negro on the San Francisco streetcars. Mother gave me the money to have my blue serge suit tailored, and I learned to fill out work cards, operate the money changer, and punch transfers. The time crowded together, and at an end of days, I was swinging on the back of a rackety trolley, smiling sweetly and persuading my charges to step forward in the car, please. For one whole semester, the streetcars and I shimmied up and scooted down the sheer hills of San Francisco. I lost some of my need for the black ghetto's shielding sponge quality as I clanged and cleared my way down Market Street, with its honky-tonk homes for homeless sailors, past the quiet retreat of Golden Gate Park, and along closed, undwelled-in-looking dwellings of the Sunset District. My work shifts were split so haphazardly that it was easy to believe that my superiors had chosen them maliciously. Upon mentioning my suspicions to Mother, she said, "Don't worry about it. You ask for what you want, and you pay for what you get. And I'm going to show you that it ain't no trouble when you pack double." She stayed awake to drive me out to the car barn at 4:30 in the mornings, or to pick me up when I was relieved just before dawn. Her awareness of life's perils convinced her that while I would be safe on the public conveyances, she wasn't about to trust a taxi driver with her baby. When the spring classes began, I resumed my commitment with formal education. I was so much wiser and older, so much more independent, with a bank account and clothes that I had bought for myself, that I was sure that I had learned and earned the magic formula which would make me a part of the gay life my contemporaries led. Not a bit of it. Within weeks, I realized that my schoolmates and I were on paths moving diametrically away from each other. They were concerned and excited over the approaching football games. But I had, in my immediate past, raced a car down a dark and foreign Mexican mountain. They concentrated great interest on who was worthy of being student body president, and when the metal bands would be removed from their teeth, while I remembered sleeping for a month in a wrecked automobile and conducting a streetcar in the uneven hours of the morning. Without willing it, I had gone from being ignorant of being ignorant to being aware of being aware. And the worst part of my awareness was that I didn't know what I was aware of. I knew very little, but I was certain that the things I had yet to learn wouldn't be taught to me at George Washington High School. I began to cut classes, to walk in Golden Gate Park, or wander along the shiny counter of the Emporium department store. When Mother discovered that I was playing truant, she told me that if I didn't want to go to school one day, if there were no tests being held, and if my schoolwork was up to standard, all I had to do was tell her and I could stay home. She said that she didn't want some white woman calling her up to tell her something about her child that she didn't know. And she didn't want to be put in the position of lying to a white woman because I wasn't woman enough to speak up. That put an end to my truancy. But nothing appeared to light the long, gloomy day that going to school became. To be left alone on the tightrope of youthful unknowing is to experience the excruciating beauty of full freedom and the threat of eternal indecision. Few, if any, survive their teens. Most surrender to the vague but murderous pressure of adult conformity. It becomes easier to die and avoid conflicts than to maintain a constant battle with the superior forces of maturity. Until recently, each generation found it more expedient to plead guilty to the charge of being young and ignorant, easier to take the punishment meted out by the older generation, which had itself confessed to the same crime short years before. The command to grow up at once was more bearable than the faceless horror of wavering purpose, which was youth. The bright hours when the young rebelled against the descending sun had to give way to 24-hour periods called days that were named as well as numbered. The black female is assaulted in her tender years by all those common forces of nature at the same time that she is caught in the tripartite crossfire of masculine prejudice, white illogical hate, and black lack of power. The fact that the adult American Negro female emerges a formidable character is often met with amazement, distaste, and even belligerence. It is seldom accepted as an inevitable outcome of the struggle won by survivors and deserves respect, if not enthusiastic acceptance. 35. The Well of Loneliness was my introduction to lesbianism and what I thought of as pornography. For months, the book was both a treat and a threat. It allowed me to see a little of the mysterious world of the pervert. It stimulated my libido, and I told myself that it was educational because it informed me of the difficulties in the secret world of the pervert. I was certain that I didn't know any perverts. Of course, I ruled out the jolly sissies who sometimes stayed at our house and cooked whopping 8-course dinners while the perspiration made paths down their made-up faces. Since everyone accepted them, and more particularly, since they accepted themselves, I knew their laughter was real and that their lives were cheerful comedies interrupted only by costume changes and freshening of makeup. But the true freaks, the women lovers, captured yet strained my imagination. They were, according to the book, disowned by their families, snubbed by their friends, and ostracized from every society. This bitter punishment was inflicted upon them because of a physical condition over which they had no control. After my third reading of The Well of Loneliness, I became a bleeding heart for the downtrodden, misunderstood lesbians. I thought lesbian was synonymous with hermaphrodite, and when I wasn't actively aching over their pitiful state, I was wondering how they managed simpler body functions. Did they have a choice of organs to use, and if so, did they alternate or play favorite? Or I tried to imagine how two hermaphrodites made love, and the more I pondered, the more confused I became. It seemed that having two of everything other people had, and four where ordinary people had just two, would complicate matters to the point of giving up the idea of making love at all. It was during this reflective time that I noticed how heavy my own voice had become. It droned and drummed 2 or 3 whole tones lower than my schoolmates' voices. My hands and feet were also far from being feminine and dainty. In front of the mirror, I detachedly examined my body. For a 16-year-old, my breasts were sadly undeveloped. They could only be called skin swellings, even by the kindest critic. The line from my rib cage to my knees fell straight without even a ridge to disturb its direction. Younger girls than I boasted of having to shave under their arms, but my armpits were as smooth as my face. There was also a mysterious growth developing on my body that defied explanation. It looked totally useless. Then the question began to live under my blanket. How did lesbianism begin? What were the symptoms? The public library gave information on the finished lesbian, and that woefully sketchy, but on the growth of a lesbian, there was nothing. I did discover that the difference between hermaphrodites and lesbians was that hermaphrodites were born that way. It was impossible to determine whether lesbians budded gradually or burst into being with a suddenness that dismayed them as much as it repelled society. I had gnawed into the unsatisfying books and into my own unstocked mind without finding a morsel of peace or understanding. And meantime, my voice refused to stay up in the higher registers where I consciously pitched it, and I had to buy my shoes in the old ladies' comfort section of the shoe stores. I asked Mother. Daddy Clydell was at the club one evening, so I sat down on the side of Mother's bed. As usual, she woke completely and at once. There's never any yawning or stretching with Vivian Baxter. She's either awake or asleep. Mother, I've got to talk to you. It was going to kill me to have to ask her, for in the asking, wouldn't it be possible that suspicion would fall on my own normality? I knew her well enough to know that if I committed almost any crime and told her the truth about it, she not only wouldn't disown me, but she would give me her protection. But just suppose I was developing into a lesbian. How would she react? And then there was Bailey to worry about, too. Ask me and pass me a cigarette. Her calmness didn't fool me for a minute. She used to say that her secret to life was that she hoped for the best, was prepared for the worst, so anything in between couldn't come as a surprise. That was all well and good for most things, but if her only daughter was developing into a... She moved over and patted the bed. Come on, baby, get in the bed. You'll freeze before you get your question out. It was better to remain where I was for the time being. Mother, my pocketbook. Riti, do you mean your vagina? Don't use those southern terms. There's nothing wrong with the word vagina. It's a clinical description. Now what's wrong with it? The smoke collected under the bed lamp, then floated out to be free in the room. I was deathly sorry that I had begun to ask her anything. Well, have you got crabs? Since I didn't know what they were, that puzzled me. I thought I might have them, and it wouldn't go well for my side if I said I didn't. On the other hand, I just might not have them, and suppose I lied and said I did. I don't know, Mother. Do you itch? Does your vagina itch? She leaned on one elbow and jabbed out her cigarette. No, Mother. Then you don't have crabs. If you had them, you'd tell the world. I wasn't sorry or glad not to have them, but made a mental note to look up crabs in the library on my next trip. She looked at me closely, and only a person who knew her face well could have perceived the muscles relaxing and interpreted this as an indication of concern. You don't have a venereal disease, do you? The question wasn't asked seriously, but knowing Mother, I was shocked at the idea. Why, Mother, of course not. That's a terrible question. I was ready to go back to my room and wrestle alone with my worries. Sit down, Reedy. Pass me another cigarette. For a second, it looked as if she was thinking about laughing. That would really do it. If she laughed, I'd never tell her anything else. Her laughter would make it easier to accept my social isolation and human freakishness. But she wasn't even smiling, just slowly pulling in the smoke and holding it in puffed cheeks before blowing it out. Mother, something is growing on my vagina. There, it was out. I'd soon know whether I was to be her ex-daughter or if she'd put me in a hospital for an operation. Where on your vagina, Marguerite? Uh-oh, it was bad, all right. Not Riti or Maya or baby. Marguerite. On both sides, inside. I couldn't add that they were fleshy skin flaps that had been growing for months down there. She'd have to pull that out of me. Riti, go get me that big Webster's and then bring me a bottle of beer. Suddenly, it wasn't all that serious. I was Riti again, and she just asked for beer. If it had been as awful as I anticipated, she'd have ordered scotch and water. I took her the huge dictionary that she bought as a birthday gift for Daddy Clydell and laid it on the bed. The weight forced the side of the mattress down, and Mother twisted her bed lamp to beam down on the book. When I returned from the kitchen and poured her beer, as she had taught Bailey and me beer should be poured, she patted the bed. "Sit down, baby. Read this." Her fingers guided my eyes to vulva. I began to read. She said, "Read it out loud." It was all very clear and normal sounding. She drank the beer as I read, and when I had finished, she explained it in everyday terms. My relief melted the fears, and they liquidly stole down my face. Mother shot up and put her arms around me. "There's nothing to worry about, baby. It happens to every woman. It's just human nature." It was all right then to unburden my heavy, heavy heart. I cried into the crook of my arm. I thought maybe I was turning into a lesbian. Her patting of my shoulder slowed to a still, and she leaned away from me. "A lesbian? Where the hell did you get that idea?" "Those things growing on my vagina, and my voice is too deep, and my feet are big, and I have no hips or breasts or anything, and my legs are so skinny." Then she did laugh. I knew immediately that she wasn't laughing at me. Or rather, she was laughing at me, but it was something about me that pleased her. The laugh choked a little on the smoke in its way, but finally broke through cleanly. I had to give a small laugh, too, although I wasn't tickled at all. But it's mean to watch someone enjoy something and not show your understanding of their enjoyment. When she finished with the laughter, she laid it down a peel at a time and turned to me, wiping her eyes. "I made arrangements a long time ago to have a boy and a girl. Bailey is my boy and you are my girl. The man upstairs, he don't make mistakes. He gave you to me to be my girl, and that's just what you are. Now go wash your face, have a glass of milk, and go back to bed." I did as she said, but I soon discovered my new assurance wasn't large enough to fill the gap left by my old uneasiness. It rattled around in my mind like a dime in a tin cup. I hoarded it preciously. But less than 2 weeks later, it became totally worthless. A classmate of mine, whose mother had rooms for herself and her daughter in a lady's residence, had stayed out beyond closing time. She telephoned me to ask if she could sleep at my house. Mother gave her permission, providing my friend telephoned her mother from our house. When she arrived, I got out of bed, and we went to the upstairs kitchen to make hot chocolate. In my room, we shared mean gossip about our friends, giggled over boys, and whined about school and the tedium of life. The unusualness of having someone sleep in my bed, I'd never slept with anyone except my grandmother's, and the frivolous laughter in the middle of the night made me forget simple courtesies. My friend had to remind me that she had nothing to sleep in. I gave her one of my gowns, and without curiosity or interest, I watched her pull off her clothes. At none of the early stages of undressing was I in the least conscious of her body, Then suddenly, for the briefest eye span, I saw her breasts. I was stunned. They were shaped like light brown falsies in the 5- and 10-cent store. But they were real. They made all the nude paintings I had seen in museums come to life. In a word, they were beautiful. A universe divided what she had from what I had. She was a woman. My gown was too snug for her and much too long. And when she wanted to laugh at her ridiculous image, I found that humor had left me without a promise to return. Had I been older, I might have thought that I was moved by both an aesthetic sense of beauty and the pure emotion of envy. But those possibilities did not occur to me when I needed them. All I knew was that I had been moved by looking at a woman's breast. So all the calm and casual words of mother's explanation a few weeks earlier and the clinical terms of Noah Webster did not alter the fact that in a fundamental way there was something queer about me. I somersaulted deeper into my snuggery of misery. After a thorough self-examination, in the light of all I had read and heard about dykes and bulldaggers, I reasoned that I had none of the obvious traits. I didn't wear trousers, or have big shoulders, or go in for sports, or walk like a man, or even want to touch a woman. I wanted to be a woman, but that seemed to me to be a world to which I was to be eternally refused entrance. What I needed was a boyfriend. A boyfriend would clarify my position to the world, and even more important, to myself. A boyfriend's acceptance of me would guide me into that strange and exotic land of frills and femininity. Among my associates, there were no takers. Understandably, the boys of my age and social group were captivated by the yellow or light brown-skinned girls with hairy legs and smooth little lips, and whose hair hung down like horses' manes. And even those sought-after girls were asked to give it up or tell where it is. They were reminded in a popular song of the times, "If you can't smile and say yes, please don't cry and say no." If the pretties were expected to make the supreme sacrifice in order to belong, what could the unattractive female do? She, who had been skimming along on life's turning but never changing periphery, had to be ready to be a buddy by day and maybe by night. She was called upon to be generous only if pretty girls were unavailable. I believe most plain girls are virtuous because of the scarcity of opportunity to be otherwise. They shield themselves with an aura of unavailableness, for which after a time they begin to take credit, largely as a defense tactic. In my particular case, I could not hide behind the curtain of voluntary goodness. I was being crushed by two unrelenting forces: the uneasy suspicion that I might not be a normal female, and my newly awakening sexual appetite. I decided to take matters into my own hands, an unfortunate but apt phrase. Up the hill from our house, and on the same side of the street, lived two handsome brothers. They were easily the most eligible young men in the neighborhood. If I was going to venture into sex, I saw no reason why I shouldn't make my experiment with the best of the lot. I didn't really expect to capture either brother on a permanent basis, but I thought if I could hook one temporarily, I might be able to work the relationship into something more lasting. I planned a chart for seduction, with surprise as my opening ploy. One evening, as I walked up the hill, suffering from youth's vague malaise, there was simply nothing to do. The brother I had chosen came walking directly into my trap. "Hello, Marguerite." He nearly passed me. I put the plan into action. "Hey," I plunged, "would you like to have a sexual intercourse with me?" Things were going according to the chart. His mouth hung open like a garden gate. I had the advantage, and so I pressed it. Take me somewhere. His response lacked dignity, but in fairness to him, I admit that I had left him little chance to be suave. He asked, "You mean you're going to give me some trim?" I assured him that that was exactly what I was about to give him. Even as the scene was being enacted, I realized the imbalance in his values. He thought I was giving him something, and the fact of the matter was it was my intention to take something from him. His good looks and popularity had made him so inordinately conceited that they blinded him to that possibility. We went to a furnished room occupied by one of his friends, who understood the situation immediately and got his coat and left us alone. The seductee quickly turned off the lights. I would have preferred them left on, but didn't want to appear more aggressive than I had been already, if that was possible. I was excited rather than nervous, and hopeful instead of frightened. I had not considered how physical an act of seduction would be. I had anticipated long, soulful tongued kisses and gentle caresses, but there was no romance in the knee which forced my legs, nor in the rub of hairy skin on my chest. Unredeemed by shared tenderness, the time was spent in laborious gropings, pullings, yankings, and jerkings. Not one word was spoken. My partner showed that our experience had reached its climax by getting up abruptly, and my main concern was how to get home quickly. He may have sensed that he had been used, or his disinterest may have been an indication that I was less than gratifying. Neither possibility bothered me. Outside on the street, we left each other with little more than, "Okay, see you around." Thanks to Mr. Freeman, 9 years before, I had had no pain of entry to endure. And because of the absence of romantic involvement, neither of us felt much had happened. At home, I reviewed the failure and tried to evaluate my new position. I had had a man. I had been had. I not only didn't enjoy it, but my normalcy was still a question. What happened to the moonlight on the prairie feeling? Was there something so wrong with me that I couldn't share a sensation that made poets gush out rhyme after rhyme, that made Richard Arlen brave the Arctic wastes and Veronica Lake betray the entire free world? There seems to be no explanation for my private infirmity, but being a product, is victim a better word, of the Southern Negro upbringing, I decided that I would understand it all better by and by. I went to sleep. 3 weeks later, having thought very little of the strange and strangely empty night, I found myself pregnant. 36. The world had ended, and I was the only person who knew it. People walked along the streets as if the pavements hadn't all crumbled beneath their feet. They pretended to breathe in and out, while all the time I knew the air had been sucked away in a monstrous inhalation from God Himself. I alone was suffocating in the nightmare. The little pleasure I was able to take from the fact that if I could have a baby, I obviously wasn't a lesbian, was crowded into my mind's tiniest corner by the massive pushing in of fear, guilt, and self-revulsion. For eons, it seemed, I had accepted my plight as the hapless, put-upon victim of fate and the Furies. But this time, I knew I had to face the fact that I had brought my new catastrophe upon myself. How was I to blame the innocent man whom I had lured into making love to me? In order to be profoundly dishonest, a person must have one of two qualities. Either he is unscrupulously ambitious, or he is unswervingly egocentric. He must believe that for his ends to be served, all things and people can justifiably be shifted about, or that he is the center not only of his own world, but of the worlds which others inhabit.